Transmission. I have studied for years to find my definition. And in trying to find self-definition, I realized the interrelation between myself and everybody else, between myself and the universe. Alan Watts would have us give up in despair and have us humbly return to the chemistry of nature. I am referring to his work called The Book. Materialism and agnosticism come easy. It is less difficult to surrender to fatalism than it is to try to enhance your own consciousness. We live in times when hedonism has not only become the political opiate of the poor, but it is also the prescription by the psychiatrist for all who have troubles that he cannot cure, and to ask radical questions that he cannot answer, and yet should answer, because whatever troubles the mind is his responsibility, not to shirk nor to evade answers. Mankind as a whole boasts an intellectual ego. Mankind encourages individuals who tell mankind that they are scientists, and as such are methodical thinkers whose thinking leads inexorably to the truth, and consequently to the realization of summa bona for all mankind. We find these pseudo-gods of rectitude, these pretenders to infallibility, to be unable to answer questions in their domain and to explain phenomena governed by the laws that they claim for the backbone of their professional stance. Nobody would think of doubting the material scientists, the physicists, the chemists, and the mathematicians. Science reached certain conclusions, and every budding young scientist memorized from the textbooks of authority, hardly daring to ask questions as to the method by which certain laws were ascertained. It is like the procedure for finding the square root of a number. They say it is explainable, but that it is better just to use the formula and forget about the reasoning for carrying the numbers in the fashion prescribed. It works, they say, and that is all that is necessary. Yet some of these scientists dared to venture in the face of professional anathema from their superiors or pseudo-superiors. William Crookes, in a talk before the Royal Society of Chemists in 1888, suggested that the analyzation of matter would never end with the limited table of elements available at that time. He hinted that it might never end with any table of elements. He was talking of yttrium and didymium specifically, and the ability to find two new elements from the latter. However, as late as 1939, when I was majoring in chemistry in college, we were taught that there were no more than 92 or 96 possible. The Encyclopedia Britannica for 1911 lists only 92 elements, yet it begins its article on chemistry with a tribute to Crookes' radiometer, emphasizing the enormous depth that society owed to Crookes for his work. Today, true to Crookes' predictions, we have over 100 elements with no end in sight. Crookes went on to work with spiritualism and witness materializations that would not be recognized by science today, even though he photographed them. We look at some of these phenomena and wonder at the hard-headedness of professionals who fear to admit that there is something they do not know. Levitations occur. There is a book on it by Crawford that is hard to find because at the time it was printed, it was touted by the experts as dealing with a subject of legerdemain, not actual levitation contrary to the laws of gravity. We hear of a Russian lady moving salt and pepper shakers and hear of Yuri Geller, who presumably can bend metal objects with mind power. And if these things are true, we need to have another look at the whole world of science. If there is such a thing as bona fide faith healing, then it is the responsibility of medical science to broaden its scope, not to denounce the novelty. If exorcism is a workable function that demonstrates that there are entities who are able to seriously affect our lives and behavior, then it is the responsibility of the psychiatric scientists to broaden their scope, not to pretend that the whole concept of entities will go away if we ignore it. Men like Crookes and Swedenborg dropped the tools of science and started looking in other directions because of a decision that science was not going to answer the real serious problems of mankind, and because of another decision that they did not consider it futile to embark upon esoteric endeavors. It is my belief that there are many men, unique men, of their caliber who have reversed their course, so to speak, and that they felt there was some key not yet found that might unlock the whole puzzle of creation, the visible creation, that is. We hear of earlier scientists in their quest for the philosopher's stone, the universal catalyst. Some say that it was a search for a gold catalyst. Others think that the alchemists were really looking for a key that would answer spiritual questions. I am not speaking of the general urge by the inquisitive scientists to simply delve deeply and more deeply into the given paths of their science, hoping for any new discovery. I am talking about the hunch or intuition that some great scientists have, that whispers convincingly to them that there is a universal constant, which they are not taking into consideration as conventional scientists, that there is a key which, when found, will open up perspective in all directions and possibly answer all questions. Emerson, in his essay on Plato, would have us believe that all progressive thinkers along these lines are Platonists. But Plato was not the first philosopher. He followed Pythagoras and Socrates and supposedly studied under them. William Crookes used the word protyle to express that which might be the missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle. Crookes will be remembered for his work with the radiometer, but the word protyle has been forgotten even by the Webster Dictionary. It is not listed. When I was 22 years of age, I realized that science was truly the serpent engorged with its own tail. I lost interest in chemistry with its infinite tangentialities. I noticed that there were men like Crookes, Swedenborg, and Eliphas Levi, Lewis Constant, who had previously decided that the old railroad tracks would only take you where there are old railroad tracks. It is possible that the missing piece may be, in reality, missing pieces. Or, in other words, we may discover several ways or languages for describing this new perspective. It is possible that some of the magical discoveries are only partial discoveries, but that is not to be lamented. Each revelation that implies a departure from previous conviction gives hope, at least, for more effort and more revelation. At one time, faith was thought to be the ultimate discovery. It may only be a law subject to other conditions. Faith may have been the lever or mechanism by which the universe was created. However, our individual faith does not always work too well because the individual often tries to match his motivated faith against the whole structure of nature without knowing it. Faith is definitely a law that has cosmic roots, but as a law, it gives us no inkling as to the cause of ourselves or the universe. The man who wrote the book titled The Crack in the Cosmic Egg senses that there is yet an unexplained method of working things to our own benefit if we could just find it. A unique way of holding the head, perhaps. Some manner of running between the raindrops. This brings us to the first step in this particular paper. It is based upon my belief that, like faith, there is another universal constant. It is simply tension. I find that all who write about new theories try to use convincing terminology, portentous scientific borrowings, and weary philosophic argumentation, so much so that their labor in that direction confuses the reader and promotes doubt because of the borrowing of doubtful sources. I think that these things can be described simply. 1,000 hours of argument is not as convincing as the gentle touch of a girl when we are passionate, nor as conclusive as the blow of a mace on our heads by the police when we are dissident. There is a lot of philosophy in a policeman's mace. I know better than to bludgeon or to woo, but I will try to be brief by using simple terms because I am convinced that this is the best way to communicate. If the understanding of the principle of tension embraces and explains such phenomena as parental love, sexual violence, and fear of the grave, then such understanding will give at least a utility value to this paper, if nothing else. And as with the law of faith, this principle of tension can be exercised within limitations by us to achieve some goals previously not considered in the cards for us. Tension is, beyond a doubt, the reason for seeking for the universal constant. Tension, like God, makes us look for it or understand it. If we look about us, we will lose some of our conviction that mankind is not looking for it, that all of mankind is hopelessly locked in despair and the narcoticism of hedonism. The little child caught between the parental games and the disciplines of schooling plays little games to show that his uncomplicated mind presumes that there is an uncomplicated way of having things come out in his favor. His intuitions come to him without any logical sophistication. He hops over cracks in the pavement, making it a ritual to ward off trouble or to ensure luck. He presses his nose to the window pane and tries both negative and positive appeals to nature when the snow begins to fall, because this child somehow thinks he can affect the forces of nature and cause it to snow for him. He never really grows up, in a way. Doctors and mathematicians, when playing poker, will superstitiously employ similar totemic implementations. They will not sit in a certain seat. They must cut the cards three times. They repeat little mantras inside their heads while dealing. They will not pick up the cards until all are dealt. They believe that a deck of cards can become unlucky, and they will ask for a new deck. They will blame a man standing behind them if they have bad luck. Some children, when they grow up, become magicians. If their desires lead them toward finding material levers for that which seems to be a strictly material world. Kabbalism, astrology, and numerology are all attempts to find the universal constant. Out of this intuition that man has for the universal constant have evolved many esoteric sciences, religious rituals, and cult gimmicks. And it can be admitted that some of them work, but only in specific instances or in limited fields or with limited results, and never with a true knowledge of all the factors involved. An instance of this limitation is taken from the Bible. Christ went about performing sensational miracles, but could not do much in his hometown. And he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief. The faith of Christ and his followers was no match for the unbelief of the folks back home. So that the law of faith has limitations. To move the mountains requires agreeable believing mountains. Science and sorcery alike rely upon prediction, and both will continue to fail until they learn all the factors. If an omnipotent God had been behind the attempts for miracles at Nazareth, there would have been no failure. This means then that Jesus was operating from the quantum of faith power that he had generated away from Nazareth and among people more likely to accept him. We can examine faith then as being a sort of universal constant that is subject to certain conditions. It would seem that if we were to make the law of faith work, we would have to find some science to control these conditions and factors. The first condition is that faith must be universal. Nothing happens if we alone have faith. Another condition is that the implementation of the law of faith, which might be called an act of faith, produces the desired phenomenal result only at a point of gracefulness and balance. These last two words may involve quite a few factors. A woman touching the hem of Christ's robe may siphon off the needed quantum of energy focused in Christ and needed to perform healing in another direction. An unexpected headache or unexpected onslaught of diarrhea might cause the healer to postpone his undertaking. It has been found that an impersonal, unopinionated operator, having his attention strictly on healing with no personal or political motives, is more successful than a man with an egotistical cause. Yet, while being impersonal, he must still be dynamic. While this seems paradoxical, it implies that such action, healing, should be for the purpose of healing, not for the sake of an ego. Christ could not heal where there was unbelief or irritation. The operator cannot work under strain. He must succeed because of previous, possibly lesser, successes. He cannot be under tension. Intention is the factor that causes the search for miracles. Intention helps the realization of those miracles, but unless understood, it is the negativity of those same miracle phenomena if counter-tension can be introduced. Disbelief will kill the phenomena or miracle. There is a certain adroitness in working miracles or producing phenomena, whether it be healing or transmission. This adroitness I would like to call the science of betweenness. More must be said of it later. It is the art of bringing about conditions by which various laws will be effective, so that in the case of faith healing, measures would be employed to prevent failure from disbelief or from undue strain on the part of the operator. In my earlier years, when I went about looking for books and teachers, page 8, I learned that there were very few groups on earth that diligently looked for any alkahest or universal constant. Do not be over charitable at this point and indicate that all religious people are looking for it. All men seek the truth, but half-heartedly and almost unconsciously. The beginners of the great religions and their immediate disciples were seekers, but from then on, most of the adherents to a given religion were and are acceptors and devotees of mummery. I found that most of the individuals or groups engaged in the work of finding a universal constant or employing at least some specific catalyst were not only secretive, but possibly hard to find as well. The Gurdjieffian sect was an exception. Certain Zen teachers might be qualified to come into this category, but the most are pretenders to the right of an ancient, unknown heritage, the inheritance of the mantle from a genuine heir of Buddha. Percival claimed to have found a specific catalyst. His system was similar to the systems of Kundalini Yoga that emanate from India. Percival supposedly mistakenly left the impression that his system would lead to conscious corporeal immortality. Not much had been heard of him since his death. Gurdjieff later claimed to some knowledge of a universal constant. However, some of his disciples left him. The English segment, I am told, because he claimed he could control his own destiny. It was after an automobile accident that those disciples decided he did not have the needed magic or formula to control the environment. Nevertheless, Gurdjieff had something. He had power. Fritz Peters claimed that he was healed by Gurdjieff almost instantaneously. The writings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky are not wasted. These men at least found some specific catalysts, or they found mechanisms, which we call disciplines, that worked and brought about an increase in self-awareness. That which is already available is the knowledge of specific catalysts. These include the law of faith, the various laws mentioned in the Albigen papers, and certain laws on energy, which this paper will explain. Gurdjieff was able to utilize these laws of energy, if I am to presume the books by Fritz Peters are true accounts. Christ knew of this law also, or he would not have been aware of the drain on his quantum of energy when the woman touched his garment hem. The sad commentary may be that the teaching of the mechanics of creating, conserving, and projecting energy may have been a vocal teaching not committed to writing in both the case of Gurdjieff and Christ, if it was taught or given at all.